Hello, this is Tom Campbell, your host for a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. The following interview is with Ralph Ortiz from Alpha Productions. Today is June 25th, 2011, and I'm talking with Ralph Ortiz from Alpha Productions. Ralph, if you don't mind, what is your full name, your date of birth, and your hometown?
Okay, my full name is Ralph Ortiz. My date of birth is March 10th, 1937. And my hometown? Well, I guess it's New York.
What part of New York?
Queens.
And when did you come to Minneapolis?
I was 16. I came to Hopkins, Minnesota with my parents, of course, and went to Hopkins High School, and then I went to University of Minnesota after that.
Did you see bands while you were during that time period?
Not a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't recall a lot happening in that time period.
What did you do after high school?
Well, after the University of Minnesota, I got into packaging, and I sold packaging, and I would do some minor traveling. When I started in this business, I ended up going to Duluth for Gino's Pizza packaging, and I went to a bar, and there the Titans were playing, and I was really impressed on how well they handled themselves vocally. You know, the word commercial bothered people in those days. You were commercial, that was bad, you know, but it wasn't bad. But what commercial really meant is that you were playing things that people wanted to hear, mm-hmm. and you were doing a dance beat, and you made an interesting presentation.
What year was this, Ralph?
1967.
67, mm-hmm. Okay.
So anyway, the band, during the break, they sat down behind me on another table, and I overheard one of the fellas say that they wished the heck they could get out of Duluth. They were so tired of being in Duluth. And so I struck up a conversation with them, and because I knew that there was an opening in downtown Minneapolis at one of the better bars down there called Duff's. I knew Joe Duffy. I ended up putting them together. I told Joe Duffy about them. I told them about Joe Duffy, and I didn't think about it after that. And about maybe a month after that, I went down to Duff's, and there the Titans were playing. And they got all excited when they saw me. And during the break, you know, they came over and they said, "Oh, Ralph, so good to see you. You really helped us out. Do you know that if you were our agent, you'd be making 10%? And I went, "Oh," a light bulb went off in my head. I said, "Well, that's really interesting." And they said, "You know, there's a band up in Duluth right now called the XL5. And they're really good, and they all five of them play horns, and they all sing lead, and they do really the top 40 like we do, except they also are heavy into R&B, which was, that's the kind of music I love, so I got excited about that. Mm-hmm. So I went up to see the XL5. I made a deal with the XL5. I said, "Hey, I'm the guy that got the Titans their job." And they said, "Oh, yeah, well, let's talk." You know, everyone had heard how the Titans had come down to Minneapolis. I made a deal with them. Made a deal with Joe Duffy and the Titans where we could use Duff's one night on a Monday night to showcase the XL5. Mm-hmm. So everybody agreed to that, and I brought in about 6-7 club owners. The XL5 performed, and in a sense, it was an audition. It was great to do that because I had these club owners all looking at each other. They all knew each other, and it was kind of a competition set up there. And because of that, I could really get them a good price. Mm-hmm. So I ended up getting him a 3-month contract to start with at the Gables.
The Gables was located where?
It's located on Lindale. I don't recall what the other street. Franklin, that's right. Franklin and Lindale. The Gables eventually became the Home Saloon, but that's another part of the story.
Oh, okay. It was the same as the Home Bar.
The Home Bar, yeah.
The Home Bar.
Yeah. I started the Home Bar, but we'll talk about that as we get to it. Okay. So what happened with the XL5, we got him a job at the Gables. And then the XL5 say to me, "Well, you know, there's a band up in Duluth that's just like us, except there's 6 guys, and they all play horns and do this and that. So, and I don't even, you know, I can't remember the name of this band, but anyway, I did the same thing, did the same kind of audition, except this time it was at the Gables. And then I got them a job. So now all of a sudden I've got 2 bands, I'm working part-time. One thing just led to another, and I just started looking. I got real interested in the business, and I studied as to what made bands popular, what made them successful, mm-hmm. figured it out. It was go out and talk with bands and help them become successful. And I would talk to club owners, and I would find out what their needs were. Most agents, they go and they talk to a club owner, and they say, I've got this band and that band, and they're hot, and they do this and that. Well, what the club owner, that doesn't make, register to the club owner. What they wanted to hear was, what are your needs? What kind of crowds do you want to attract? And what kind of music do you want? Like that type of thing. So I would go in and relate to the club owner, and then I'd present him bands with what his needs were, and I'd give him advice. And because of that, the agency got just bigger and bigger and bigger, and I went full-time into it, and then I started hiring agents, and then I became involved nationally with a group called the International Theatrical Agency Association, and I got on the board of directors, and because of that, I could import and export bands out of Minneapolis quite easily.
And where would they play?
They would play around the northern tier of the United States. They'd go up to Illinois and even go into the Dakotas. Mm-hmm. I would do a lot of business in the Chicago area, which brings other stories too. But at any rate, that's how we started.
Okay. What did you find the club owners were looking for in 1967?
In 1967, they wanted bands that would play not too loud, because the bands would come in there and they'd just crank right up, and the club owners weren't used to that. So they wanted that. So I always have to be like a referee between the band and the club owner. Mm-hmm. They wanted that. They wanted dance music. And they wanted bands that played music that people would recognize. Now, if the band had original material, that'd be okay if they just had one or two songs and they were fun to listen to and interesting. But if it was just some wild thing that nobody cared about and the people would wander around, the club owners didn't like that. So I advised the bands that they should be playing music that the people could relate to. They should be playing it either like the record or better than the record. Embellish the things that were fun in the song. Mm-hmm. Make it more interesting. That's what the club owners wanted.
Now, the XL5, when you first met them in Duluth,
yes,
were they wearing the matching suits and so forth, or was that something later on?
That came later.
Okay. So you pretty much start up Alpha Productions on your own?
Oh, yes.
And you have an office located where?
In Burnsville, I started an office.
Okay, so you go into this full-time?
Eventually I did, yeah. Within about, I'd say a year and a half, I went into it full-time.
So in addition to the bands from Duluth, you started with the Titans.
Yes.
The XL5.
Yes. And then the third band, I can't remember their name.
Also from Duluth. And then did you go on from there to pick up local bands? Or what was
not
that?
In Duluth. Well, local bands in the Twin Cities. Yeah, I would go around and look at the local bands and see what they were doing. The ones that were interested in having better gigs, because the gigs I was booking were higher price gigs, where the bands were playing close to minimum union wages, where my bands were making more than that.
And the reason you were able to get more money for the bands was?
Because the bands were more successful, they would sell more booze.
Ah, okay.
That was the bottom line. What were the sales at the end of the week?
Which obviously relates to how many people you bring in.
Yes.
To the club.
Yes.
What were some of the local clubs you would go out and see bands at? You mentioned the Gables.
The CC Tap was a place that I started. In fact, I started a relationship with Pete Pusalis at the CC Tap, and I became his only booker forever. Mm-hmm.
That's South Minneapolis on Lindale Avenue.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. I eventually worked. I also was the exclusive booker for the Left Guard.
And
they were on the Beltline.
On 494?
494, yeah.
In Richfield?
Maybe that's Richfield or Bloomington. Bloomington, that is.
Okay. Any other clubs you...
Oh, yeah, the Rusty Nail.
That was also the...
That was in, I believe, Robbinsdale.
Okay.
Rusty Nail. The Caboose, the Union Bar.
The Caboose? The Caboose, you mean, on...
By the university.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Caboose.
And Union Bar, both. I used to book both of those. I just made some notes here. This is so many years ago. I don't really recall all the places. But one of my favorite places is an odd place in Hudson, Wisconsin called Dibbo's.
Dibbo's?
Yes.
What was that all about?
It was a really nice, large, very large nightclub in Hudson. And in those days, it was the only place that you could get a beer on Sunday was to go to Wisconsin. So it was monster bar on Sunday night, you know, and I used to showcase my bands there. I used to bring in my best bands, Vic was the owner, and was very cooperative, very great guy.
So your top bands during this early period, 67, 68, would have been which bands?
Well, I think the XL5, the Titans, I'm just looking here. Most of these bands on my list that I wrote down here, they all were after that. But then after that, I started I started getting involved with Free and Easy, and I was really impressed with Free and Easy.
Do you remember the first place you saw them at?
Someplace in St. Paul.
The Jockey Lounge?
That was a good place. I booked the Jockey Lounge too, yes. Mm-hmm. I might have seen them in the Jockey Lounge initially, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed with Free and Easy. I was impressed with their band leader, Tom Bear. I was so impressed with Tom Bear, I talked him into becoming an agent for me.
Really?
And he was a very good agent, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Was he the first agent you hired then? Or?
No, he wasn't. My first agent, I think, was Gary Johnson.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the company's growing and...
Well, then I hired Bill Hughes and Rick Leibold. Rick Leibold used to buy bands from us. He was at the university, and he had a position where he would buy the bands for events. And when he graduated, he was so enthusiastic about the business, and he liked Alpha so much, he came and applied to work as an agent with us, in which we took him on because he's a great guy. And he did very well. He could get on the phone. He could talk to club owners in Wisconsin and in Illinois, whatever. I gave him places to call, you know. And he could sell them bands without even going out to the club. So that was really the way to do it. If you could sell your groups without having to go out and see the club owners in person, it was far more efficient. But you'd have to have a reputation to do that, which we had, so that worked out. We also did things to make things special. We videotaped the bands. We were the first agency to videotape bands. We had a reel-to-reel tape recorder. Now, the purpose of videotaping the bands is twofold. First is so that they can see themselves and see what they're doing, because so many bands didn't realize the kind of presentation that they were making. They didn't realize that they were looking down. They didn't look like they were having any fun, you know. And I had one band where the lead singer would constantly look back at the drummer and sing to him, you know? And it was only because he was shy. And so by videotaping them, I could show them, you know, what they were doing, and I could talk to them about, you know, how to present a song. How to hold a mic and to look at people and the smile and the gaze over the crowd and emphasize the words in the song. And
so you were looking at stage presence.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That was as important as anything else.
And it was not typical at that time for bands to be videotaped and then watch themselves.
No, this was the first time that I know of that it was done in the Twin Cities. Mm-hmm. And so, but the second application of the videotape, and perhaps the most important, is we'd use that to sell the bands with. We could sit down with a club owner and in 20 minutes show him a videotapes of 10 bands and discuss the bands with him. And he wouldn't have to go out and see the bands on that. And so the club owners liked that because they were all busy and they like working with professional company. And so that's why we did it.
And were you behind the appearance of XL5 when they began wearing the matching suits and so forth?
I believe so. I don't think it was my idea. I think it was theirs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was that something new? For local bands.
Yeah, I think they were. I think they put on a white uniforms or something like that, and it made them look really cool. Yeah, But the XL5 were a smart band. They understood showmanship. They understood most everything. They didn't have to be taught anything. They were good.
And did they play more the Twin Cities or Duluth or all over?
No, they just played in this one bar forever.
And that was?
The Gables.
The Gables.
Yeah.
They were the house band?
Yes.
There, okay. And any other bands from this early time period that you recall?
The bands that came after that were as I said, Free and Easy. I started working with Danny's Reasons. The System, Zarathustra, Grizzly, Bazooka. And I learned the build 1950 bands. In other words, bands that did music from the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I built them is that they were really the successful. The first one I built was the White Sidewalls. And they would come out and act the music. They'd come out and be silly and act they'd do strange voices and stuff like that to fit the song, mm-hmm. you know. And the people loved it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would put them on a ballroom tour, and they would pack the ballrooms. I thought, well, you know, if the 50s is that hot, then I started building others. So then I built other bands, too. I don't recall their names at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just a series of bands that was doing 50s music going out.
Do you think that was inspired by the success of Sha Na Na?
Oh, definitely, yes.
Okay.
I believe that was.
And this was really the first time that bands began doing retro-style music from the 50s and early 60s.
Well, it was only just a few bands did it.
Yeah.
They specialized in it.
Mm-hmm.
On it. The regular bands, that was kind of like below them to do that.
So as the 1960s come to a close, how many bands do you have under contract and how many agents do you have?
Well, in the I was only operating 3 years in the 60s. So I don't recall. It wasn't very many, but in the peak of the agency, we had 120 bands, we had 6 agents, and we booked all over, you know, like about maybe 10 states.
And the peak years would have been
the last years.
The last years.
Yes. Yeah. And 81 or so, 80-81.
What is the story behind the album Gathering at the Depot that, according to the liner notes, was recorded on Sunday, September 13, 1970, at the Depot in Minneapolis?
Well, at that time, I wanted to have a vehicle to make my bands easier to book, you know, over a larger period, larger area, and also make them more successful. And I figured that the more I could do to get my bands into a recording studio, to make them more successful, the more value I would be to them. And so I approached the owners of the Depot as to doing a recording there and to do an event there, and called The Gathering. Made all the arrangements with everybody. I had a partner in a music store, Frank Marino, and I had Frank Marino help me with the production of it. And I couldn't take credit as producer because in those days the musicians union wouldn't let an agent do anything but be an agent. They were concerned for whatever reason, so I had to have Frank Marino be the producer. So that involved the bands that are on this album. I have to tell you, it was a lot of fun. It was a great day. Everybody was in great spirits. Most of the people performed really well. And yes, we had to go into the studio after that to help some of the cuts, but it worked out.
Was that mainly to do some vocal overdubs?
Things like that, yes.
That was done at Sound 80?
Probably, yes.
Sound 80.
Yeah, I believe it was
Sound 80. Sound 80 recorded the...
Yes, Sound 80 was involved with
the
that.
The bands. And just for the record, who were the bands that came out on the album?
Well, it was Deadeye, Crockett, Chesterfield Gathering, The System, Thunder Tree, Danny's Reasons, Pepper Fog, Kiwani, Free and Easy, Grizzly, and The Litter.
Okay, and these are all bands that are under contract to Alpha.
No, The Litter wasn't.
The Litter Worm.
We put the Litter on there because they were a popular band that had run through their popularity, and they were trying to regroup again. And so I put them on there because if they could regroup, I would book them then. And also, it would help them get going again. So it was a mutual benefit type situation. So that's why I put them on there.
So the album comes out then. Did it come out in 1970 or was it early 71 before it actually got pressed up?
I don't remember.
Okay.
It came out fast. You know, we didn't want to hold it back.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall how many copies of the album were pressed up?
A little over, I think we did 10,000 and we sold them all. You know, I had a few left in my garage when we were done. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing how fast they went. And although we also pressed some to give away, and we would give them to ballroom owners.
As a promotion album.
As a promotion album, mm-hmm. right. And so, in fact, they used it as a giveaway too.
Did you have a local distributor, or did you do it all yourself? Or?
I don't recall.
Mm-hmm. But it was.
Oh yeah, we did. There's a music distributor locally. I'm trying to remember their name.
Heilitzer or Lieberman? Or?
The first one.
Heilitzer.
It's a name like that. At any rate, it was a local distributor that was did national albums, and they were aware of what we did, and they were interested in the thing, and so they kind of like helped me out.
Did you try to get the album played on local radio?
Well, it was easy because one of my partners was John Pete of KQRS.
He was a DJ?
He was a DJ, and I believe he was program director. And then True Don Blue of KDWB, he played it a lot and talked about it. And Jimmy Reed of WDGY. They were all, these three fellas were very supportive of local bands.
So the album was played on the air in the cities?
Yes,
In the cities. Mm-hmm. And as the 1970s start, a new decade.
Yes.
Were there changes in the local music scene, in the clubs, and the bands, and in the music itself?
One of the changes that happened, which I'm really quite proud of, is that in the club area, in the nicer club areas, there was never a band that played that had a mixed race band. It was all just white people in the band. And the club owners were afraid of having mixed race bands because they were afraid of having too many black people in their clubs. And so this was a stigma, this was a problem. And I overcame that problem by working with a group called the Mystics.